Hello, world. This is the Know Your Place podcast, episode 6. On this episode, I'm joined by a friend from New Zealand. That's right, the country of New Zealand. And we talk about the legacy of colonialism of the British, our preconceived notions of both countries, and where we see our countries going forward. Stay tuned. Hello, world, everyone. My name is Charles Altendorf, and this is the Know Your Place podcast. And we're on episode 6. Oh my gosh, 6 whole episodes. And this week is very special because it's the first international episode of our show. I've been dying to go international, but it's kind of tricky sometimes. So on the other end, we have Malik here. Say hello to the crowd, Malik. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Hey, everyone. Pleased to meet you. Funny story with my name. I'm actually not really sure objectively what the pronunciation is because my mother and father both say it differently from each other. Oh. Some of my cousins say it again, and I say it differently from both of them. And then they both, all three of us, say it differently from my friends and my cousins who say it differently again. And... none of that is in line with the name Mum actually wanted to give me, so...
Oh my, well, what do you prefer to be called? We'll go with that.
Honestly, I don't mind. My mum says Malik, my cousins say Malik, I say Malik, my mates say Moloch, my dad says Malik, whatever works.
Ah, okay. Well, I only called you Malik because one of the basketball players from my college, the University of Kentucky, was called Malik Monk. So that's the only experience I have with your name. So, cool, man. So, have you met any Americans before?
Yeah, quite a few. There's not a huge diaspora of them in New Zealand, but we do have them, and Australia gets a lot of American tourists from across the place. In fact, most notably, I actually had a partner who was from California.
Oh, well, that explains everything then. No, I guess if I ask you what your preconceived notions of America are, you're going to tell me much of what we would call California, are you?
Well, it's actually funny you should say that because one of the issues that actually led to our split up was visa issues between the two of us, and our one agreement was neither of us were interested in California.
That's very funny. I joke around. We have quite a few people. I live in Indiana, which is in the middle of the United States. I don't know how familiar you are with American geography, but
relatively,
yeah,
I know we're in Indiana.
And there's quite a few Californians here, and there were quite a few when I was at college at the University of Kentucky. And I joke around that they're water refugees, that they're leaving the dry area of California.
Well, California's climate can either be it's a pull and a push factor for some people. I don't mind the heat, having lived in Australia, so on and so forth, so I would find it appealing, but yeah, she often moaned it was far too hot, far too humid, and just not the sort of place she'd do. But also, you're finding a lot of Californians leaving just due to price. It's pushing a lot of people out of there.
And oh, yeah, that's the first thing anyone ever says when they talk to me about California.
Yes, well, she was outside of L.A. proper, but within L.A. County, and yeah, the prices, especially when you look at the average incomes outside of highly skilled work, it's unsustainable. I don't know how people manage.
I don't know, man. That's... it's been a problem for a while. I think part of the issue with California, if you'll allow me to wax on, I think a bunch of people move there for the sort of glamour and lifestyle that's in the movies. Especially this happened, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, and it's still happening to a degree, but I'd say it's dropping a bit. But, you know, there's a huge aura around the Hollywood thing, right? And there's hundreds of movies about somebody who moves from, like, the Midwest to Los Angeles for a new shot at life or whatever, but unfortunately, most of those people don't, you know, obviously don't become big-name actors, so then they're all kind of stuck there, and they don't have anything else to do, you know?
Well, yeah, I think California, not even just by Americans, but I think globally is quite glamorized. I can think of so many references to that in both modern media, even just growing up, the amount of people who would just, the way California gets advertised to New Zealanders, it's like, you'd think everyone there is just a Hollywood fame. I don't even know.
A Hollywood superstar, yes.
That's the one, yeah, thank you.
You think everybody there is like, let's see, Morgan Freeman or something.
That's just it. You'd think there's a red carpet everywhere and everyone's pulling up in limos. It's California, and that's what it's known for. It's almost like the state of Hollywood.
Yeah, and you know, that's quite interesting to hear, you know, because as someone who's from the middle of the country, I was born in Wisconsin and I've lived in Kentucky, Indiana, North Carolina, and Illinois. You know, that's a side of America I don't really see much, you know.
That makes sense then.
Yeah. So go ahead, I'll let you ramble on a little more. It's more interesting for me hearing this outsider perspective.
Since you've asked about my preconceptions about the states, I suppose we'll get outside California. There's 49 other states there in the union for me to comment on.
Nice.
Generally speaking, I find the U.S. quite interesting. Having dealt with Americans, also just the fact that you can't help but see a lot of what goes on in the states from outside. It's such an important nation. I find there to be a lot of incorrect preconceptions about the U.S., but not just that, not just from outsiders, even from Americans themselves sometimes. I find I've read a lot of forums for expats and immigrants who actually ended up unhappy with their new country, and a very disproportionate amount of the unhappy migrants, not just in New Zealand, also Israel, Canada, the United Kingdom, tended to be Americans who basically left just because they'd sort of lived in a bubble, often more left-leaning, where they sort of hear, like, well, you go to other countries and they've got healthcare and everyone's progressive, and they just imagine, they often leave imagining America but without all the stuff they didn't like, and then they get there and they sort of begin to realize, well, actually, yeah, America has problems, but it also has a lot of stuff I've come to miss.
Well, and that's really funny you should say that, because I don't know if you listened to episode 2 of the podcast, but my friend on there, he had moved to this town here in Indiana, which is a college town in Indiana,
and it's
known for being sort of left-leaning, and he said he got jaded with it. He's now almost pushing 40 years old. And that's very funny, because I do find that happens to people. They think that they're going to move somewhere different, and it's going to be, you know, it's just going to be more of what they want or something. And I'm not saying it doesn't happen for them. Sometimes it does. I have a friend in New York City who moved there from Kentucky who's very happy, but I also have another one who absolutely hates it.
Well, yeah, that's true, too. I mean, I know I've got another friend who moved to New Zealand he moved in from California as well, and he said he'd never move back to the States. He doesn't care about the States, hasn't missed it, hasn't revisited. And in fact, in Australia, I had another friend he was from Texas, actually.
Yeah.
And he felt the same way. He said he loves Australia. He's never missed the US. He might go back to visit one day, but it's not on his agenda now. So often it does vary. But I think the biggest thing is the reason I listed left-leaning bubbles more is because I think the big thing that matters with immigration is a need to be open-minded, because you are going to find differences. And unfortunately, I think those left-leaning bubbles in the U.S. seem a little bit less open-minded than they think they are.
Well, I often find, in general, Americans, and I think this is just because we've been the most powerful country for so long. I think we're just generally ignorant about anything outside of our bubbles in America, left or right leaning. I just in general, because people ask me all the time. I listen to a lot of documentaries that take place in other countries, and I listen to the BBC and RTE and this AM radio out of South Africa called Cape Talk, and they're like, how do you know all this stuff about these other places? And it's like, well, I just listen, you know.
And that's just it, yeah.
And I don't think the average American really bothers with any of that, because in some ways they don't need to, right? I mean,
well, exactly, they don't. When you come at the end of the day, a lot of people sort of forget that although what we see of America is only a snippet, it's a snippet that Americans don't see about into our lives, our countries. Most Americans don't know more about New Zealand than Lord of the Rings, or
actually, that's funny. Orbit. We can parlay that into my preconceived notions of New Zealand. I have very little concept of New Zealand. The main thing I kind of picked up from you and sort of other things I've read is it's just, you know, it's almost kind of rural islands with a few cities. And was Moby Dick set there? Was that in the 1800s?
I don't believe it was.
I'm thinking maybe of Australia or something. I don't know, but I did. I had a professor in college who was from Australia and made a point of showing us this YouTube video that was like, why New Zealand and Australia are different. And I still don't really know the differences. I did watch a documentary about Muldoon, though, so now I know about the government.
See, it's actually funny that you bring Muldoon up, because he actually signified a change in direction for New Zealand. Prior to him, New Zealand was a very Keynesian nation. Muldoon actually came to power. He was almost Trump-like in his mannerisms. He was an MP who he's famed for having openly criticized media, not welcomed them. He was famed for having come to Parliament drunk.
Our Canadian listeners will think of Rob Ford in Toronto.
Oh, yes, he's an interesting man as well. But to get more to it, prior to Muldoon, basically, I can't even remember how many government staff we had. We had hotels were regulated in government. Everything in the country basically was government-owned. If you needed a job, there wasn't privatized companies you could go apply for work at. You went to the government job department, lined up, and they just gave people jobs as line went down. Our tax rates were high. This was previously sustainable because Britain took care of us. As we were a heavily agricultural nation, essentially we sold them lamb, beef, milk, and vegetables in exchange for what was one of the best living standards in the world. However, once Britain departed for the EEC, basically we began to discover you can't just have everything government-owned.
And this is kind of mind-blowing for me a little bit as an American, you know, because, you know, often when we talk about countries like that, we usually think of South American countries or something, not one that's used to be part of the empire, if you will.
Oh, yeah, I mean, a lot of people aren't aware of that history of New Zealand. Even within New Zealand, a lot of people don't there are still people who don't know why Muldoon was remembered so poorly, aside from the fact that this wasn't entirely his fault. He was just continuing a legacy of what New Zealand had already established, but we changed due to the fact that it was during that final period of his governance we had ridiculous levels of inflation, unemployment was rising, people were unhappy. We were comparable to, dare I say, poorer, not very poor countries, but we were more in line with countries like Turkey and Portugal than, say, the United Kingdom and Australia and the United States. We were really falling behind.
So you all were kind of like Greece then? Is that a good modern-day example?
That is a perfect comparison. And so what we did, it was actually our left-leaning party. See, National are considered our conservatives, whereas Labour would be they don't want to be called liberals. They would be, although they were liberal at the point, they would be leftist, more sort of, they're leaning more towards social democracy and Keynesianism again, but anyway, they came out and they had what they called Rogernomics, which was named after Roger Douglas, who was their financial minister at the time. And he basically said, right. And literally overnight, they went through and just cut so many regulations. I think they got rid of about 17,000 government employees. We went from being one of the most regulated countries in the OECD to becoming the least. And I don't exaggerate when I say overnight.
That's crazy. I mean, I would be kind of concerned almost with that much change that quickly.
We were an experiment in neoliberalism globally. However, it actually, objectively, it worked. We ended up gained more tax revenue despite having lower tax thresholds just because it allowed people to start their own business, make their own money, and it wasn't all being spent. It wasn't government money going back into government hands. It was actually private investment. People were making money. It was working. And to this day, we've become one of the most competitive global economies because we've just stuck to that mantra of low taxation, relatively medium tier services. We do spend less on our military than most Anglo countries. We're able to do that because Australia essentially provides all the we're protected by geography and Australia. No one has any reason to invade us. And for anyone to try, they would have to fly through Australia first. So we've just basically, our defense budget is 0.8% of GDP. We don't really need much more. You could argue, I would be willing to go as high as maybe 1.2. Some of my friends would argue 2%, but I don't see the need for that right now to protect our interests. And, yeah, essentially that's what turned us around.
Well, that sounds very similar to what I've heard the stories of Ireland in the 90s did. They cut a lot of regulations as well, too. And it's very interesting you mentioned this because there's this institute in America called the Cato Institute. I don't know if you've heard of them. And they put out this thing called the Human Freedom Index every year. And they actually rank both you and Ireland in the top four.
I can believe that. In fact, I think I have heard that. New Zealand, it may be a different freedom index, but I'm aware we were previously ranked number one a couple of years ago.
All right, well, that's really cool. I guess we'll move into sort of this next section of our discussion where I wanted to talk about some questions we have for each other, being that we don't get to often ask people these questions, although you have more experience with Americans than I probably do with New Zealanders. However, you hit on something already that I was going to ask you. So you said that you all don't worry about military defense because you have sort of natural things that get in the way. So do you ever worry being a part of a small country? I really legitimately don't know what it's like to be a country that's not the most powerful in the world or vying for, you know.
Fair enough. Could I ask you to be a little bit more specific? What should we worry about?
I don't know. Do you ever worry that, like, I guess you don't really worry about being invaded. Do you worry about, like, just, have you read the novel 1984?
Yes, I've watched the movie.
Do you worry about a superpower ever just, you know, taking away any of your freedoms or just deciding that they want to screw with you? I guess you don't, really. You've made it sound like you don't. I'm trying to envision what... It's really crazy also for me to think about you guys are right now, technically speaking, it's Monday there and it's still Sunday here. That's kind of mind blowing for me as well. You're like a man from the future. Kind of delve into that a little. I guess do you ever worry about invasion or anything? Has New Zealand ever been invaded? Has it ever had a war?
We've had civil wars, especially between the colonial forces and the Māori. Mm. As far as invasion goes, it's actually funny you mention that. The reason New Zealand to this day is an independent country is actually we were previously governed by the state of New South Wales in Australia. And when Australia signed to become a federation, mm-hmm. they invited New Zealand, and they actually wrote us into their constitution. They wrote, as one of the original states, we came as an observer, nothing more. And we stated that we weren't going to join it in the end. That's when they wrote us in. They wrote a clause in to allow New Zealand to join whenever we want. But actually, one of the reasons we didn't join was due to the fact that we were concerned the French or the Americans might try to claim us, and we didn't want to have to wait for a response from the Australian government all the way in Canberra. So essentially, by becoming our own country, we were able to establish our own localized defenses and have the capacity to immediately call for support from Britain and Australia if anything did happen. So yeah, there was historically more militarized train of thought for New Zealand. It lasted about as long as around World War II, which was when we got heavily prepared for invasion by Japan, but they ended up never making it past Australia. And New Zealand kind of began to realize then that, well, actually, we're protected by geography alone and Australian defenses, so we started taking more and more out of our military. In fact, they had a referendum on whether or not we should keep conscription, because previously New Zealanders were conscripted for, I think, 2 years. And it actually won by about 70%. Most people wanted to keep it, but which the government thought no one would want to keep it. That's why they gave the referendum. They ended up just dropping it anyway, seeing that as an expense. But nowadays, I think if you had such a poll, far more people would vote against conscription. I personally would still back it. I believe it's conscription, but most people wouldn't.
Wow, that's quite fascinating. It's really interesting to me to hear about that. You know, being an American growing up with all these stories of invasions, and even though we haven't really seen a full scale invasion in America in a very long time as well, but that's still crazy. How far does it take you how far is it to travel to another country from your country?
Really, the only country near us is Australia, which would take me about, from Auckland, it'd be about a 2.5 hour flight. I think it's something like 1,600 kilometers, or is that miles?
Wow.
Aside from that, we've got many smaller island nations around us, but even then, most of them are protectorates of New Zealand, Australia, or the UK. So we've got the Pitcairn Islands, all of them, although it's owned by Britain, it's administrated by New Zealand, and all of them are dual citizens of the UK and New Zealand. We've got the Cook Islands, which are administered by New Zealand. We can't live there, but they're all citizens. They can live here. That's just to protect the island from over investment driving them out of their lifestyle. I suppose we've actually got the United States fairly close in terms of Hawaii and Guam.
Technically speaking, although Guam's kind of a touchy subject about whether or not it's U.S. Territory. It is U.S. territory, but it's a touchy subject about what it really means.
Yeah, it's a bit of a hard one. But yeah, there's no place that's really... And then from the south, all you really have is Antarctica.
Man, that's...
Although, I think we do fly... Even if you want to fly from Auckland, there are really only a couple of countries you can go to from here. Singapore, I think possibly Indonesia through Bali, Australia, Los Angeles, I think Santiago de Chile, and possibly Hong Kong. I think that's about it, and I'm not even certain about Hong Kong.
Yeah, man, that's crazy. So is there any questions you've ever had for an American that you're... friends haven't answered for you? I don't know. You say, so most of your experience has been with Californians then?
Yeah, predominantly. I suppose a big thing would be, do Americans tend to have more patriotism towards their state or their country? I can't quite tell when I speak to them.
Oh,
especially
man,
Texas.
That's a tough one. That's actually a great question. So, yeah, you brought up Texas. I would say, well, okay, so I was born in Wisconsin, and I would say Wisconsin has a very strong state identity, as well as Kentucky, as well as Texas, even California to a degree. I would say during World War II and World War I, prior to that, I mean, I don't know how much you know about the history of the United States. I'm assuming a good deal, but... basically, we were a bunch of states, right? You know, we were different 13 original colonies. So back in the day, the federal government was kind of just seen as a sort of an arbiter, right? Or just a negotiator. Like one of the most famous characters in Kentucky history is a guy named Henry Clay. And he was called the Great Compromiser, because he made three different deals prior to the Civil War to prevent the Civil War. And that's how strong the state identities were pre-Civil War.
Mm.
Now, after the Civil War, I would say federalism really gained a lot of traction. And then during World War I and II, I'd say we really came together as a nation. I mean, especially like if you were to... talk to my grandfather. He passed away in like 06, but he signed up to fight for the American Army during World War II. You know, he saw it as a duty to the country. And and if you go up in Wisconsin, I mean, there's still lots of American flags everywhere and this and that. It's not like people are throwing up the Wisconsin flag instead. Now, Texas, they really do believe they're their own country, kind of. I mean... at least the general vibe I get from any Texan I ever meet. I mean, they're always like Lone Star State of Mind and like, you know, very intense. but so, yeah, I will say, though, I think it's kind of eroding again. I guess it kind of goes in cycles, you know, sort of. I would say we were all united in the American Revolution, too, to a degree. You know, we wanted to be our own country. Most of the colonists now. It was a small majority, at least that's how most people describe it, like three-fifths of the colonists, but they wanted to be their own country. You know, they didn't want to be a part of England anymore. So I would say at that period we were at a kind of a high, right, after we finally got our independence, and then we fractured, and then we came together again after the Civil War, then we fractured a little, then we came together again for World War I and II. And now, as, you know, people are really starting to get jaded again with the federal government, I would say it's starting to act a little more fracturous again. So yes and no. States and federal, yes. I would say you'll meet people, though, that there'll be people who are really proud to be American.
Your mileage.
And they're really proud to be part of their state. I guess I like both, although I would say I identify with the states a little more.
I'm following along the identity theme.
especially since we've talked about sort of border protection themes as well, my next question would be, how is the kinship thing with Canadians, especially given it, America has such a heavy culture of border security, but at the same time, you've got the largest undefended border in the world is between the US and Canada, and also Canadian and US citizens can actually, if you enter a Canadian airport, you can enter through the Canadian citizen line on your US passport, and likewise, Canadians can be scanned as Americans when passing through US ports. So it's a bit of a difference compared to how you normally are with border security and identity.
Yeah, I would say we generally, I would say in places like, I guess I'll reference Wisconsin, you know, my wife, when I took her up there, she was from Kentucky, right? She thought everybody sounded like Canadians. We feel like brothers sometimes. We felt like brothers a lot in the past in certain times. But I will say that I think there is always a slight bit of mistrust there, because they have stayed so loyal to the crown.
So it is, yep.
Right, but yeah, generally speaking, most people there's generally mutual respect. Although I have also noticed, sort of, with this, with the recent few elections, it seems like there's starting to be more of a divergence.
Actually, funny you mention the crown loyalty aspect, because a lot of Canadians do tend to define themselves by not being American, and they do tend to define themselves based on the differences. But when you mention loyalty, if you actually look at a lot of UN votes, it's funny, America and the United Kingdom have actually voted heavily on some shared affairs where Canada's chosen not to vote. For example, a lot of US territories in the Indian Ocean, Mauritius led a vote to decolonize some Indian Ocean territories belonging to Britain, and Canada chose to abstain, whereas the US voted in defense of the UK.
Yeah.
In saying that, though.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
I'll let you finish. Go ahead, actually. I'll let you finish. But yeah, you're hitting on a good one.
Though, the funny thing is, the term CANZUK, which is CANZUK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, a lot of people think that was an arbitrary term coined by people who see Brexit as a chance for us to come back together. It was actually a term coined by the UN because our four nations tend to vote so similarly on so many issues so often.
Yeah, wanted to touch on the American-UK thing. I never cease to be surprised how loyal we tend to be to the British since World War II. Not that I necessarily think there's anything wrong with that per se, but it is quite interesting. I'm a little bit different. I'm not a little bit different, but I am a little bit different. Have you ever looked at what the ancestry is of the United States, the self-proclaimed ancestry?
I'm aware German Americans are the largest single demographic.
Yes, Germans and Irish are the largest too. And I always think it's kind of funny. Here I am, I'm talking to you in English, right? And we always emphasize that the UK is our strongest ally, right? But it does seem kind of weird, right? Because my ancestors were German.
It is a bit funny. Yeah. Especially with the talk of allegiance and perception of international friends, because I've seen a lot of Americans say things like, oh, well, we know when you talk about other countries, there's no closer friendship than America and the UK. But I actually wonder, I would personally have said, is that true? There's no closer military allegiance, but I think in terms of friendship, I would have said the US and Canada would be closer than the US and the UK, especially given polling in the UK has shown Brits don't share that sentiment. They view the US positively, more positively than almost any European nation, but consecutively that Brits have shown their far more cultural kinship and preference towards Australia and New Zealand than anywhere else.
Yeah, and like I said, I guess I'm kind of the minority in some aspect of Americans. I don't have anything, and I'm really glad you hit on that, because that kind of gets into the next section of what I wanted to talk about. But I'm kind of I am a bit of a UK skeptic. Now I love their music. Okay, absolutely love UK rock and roll. Like, I still listen to modern UK bands and things. I really like this band called The Wombats, and I'm a big fan of the Arctic Monkeys and some other bands. But I don't know. I think Jacob Rees-Mogg and Nigel Farage are interesting characters. I don't know. I'm just a little skeptical of them. I really am, and that I don't know if that's because I'm from, you know, the Great Lakes region as opposed to New York or something, but I don't know, man. There's something about a country that never gave up its royalty that seems kind of strange to me. And maybe that's just that could be a prejudice talking, because one of my ancestors did have their house burned down by the British during the American Revolution.
Well, I think from an American, if I'm trying to think about an American perspective on this, it probably is quite bizarre to keep royalty. But at the same time, for myself, I'm very much a royalist. I'm quite happy to keep the crown. But at the same time, I see the crown differently. For me, I'll admit, it's actually kind of funny. My tribe were among the last tribe to continue fighting the British. We started our own king movement, which we're very well known for. However, at the same time, despite that, my family specifically are quite heavily crown loyalists. Māori were not conscripted in the World Wars. However, my family still fought.
Man, that's quite fascinating, because, you know, I mean, there's some people in our country that are so skeptical of anything that resembles that kind of thing that I don't know if you remember, if you've heard much about the election of President Kennedy, but a classic thing with that was that they were very worried that he was just going to take all of his shots from the Pope, like the Pope was going to call the shots. And I see it as kind of a similar thing that, you know, we worry that, you know, everybody, New Zealand, Canada, or at least, I don't know if I personally worry about that, but that they'll take all their shots from, you know, the British crown or something.
Well, I think that's a cultural point. One thing I've come to discover is I think Americans by culture are quite distrusting of governance and quite libertarian leaning. Even those who think they want more governance, when you talk to them, you discover they quite often want less. Whereas I think out here there's more of a perception, amongst the other Anglo nations, there's more of a perception that governance in theory is fine, it's just we happen to constantly vote for idiots. But to build on that, it's like the crown are loved because they're apolitical. The queen makes a person, it's basically an unspoken rule that she doesn't get politically involved. She said very little on the topic of Britain going into the EU and said very little on Brexit. And even then, you've seen people both on the Remain and Leave side who have basically tried to infer from what she said that she might be pro-Remain or pro-Leave. And no one can really tell because she said so little to keep her own personal views to herself and allow the country to do what the country wants with her, just silently wishing for the best for Britain and the Commonwealth.
No, I get that perception a lot. I read the book How Green Was My Valley, and it's set in Wales in the coal mining community, and they just, like, everybody there just melts when, you know, one of them gets called to go sing for the Queen or something. And It's just so such a, you know, and again, I'm not saying that any of that's wrong. I actually have a degree in geography, and I draw maps during the day, so I am a bona fide geographer, I guess, to some degree. But it's just a really fascinating cultural difference for me, having grown up in, I don't know, I guess we are kind of a rogue, rebellious sort in America. I don't know. I don't know. It's I'm trying to think of sort of like, it's just sort of like I think of like movies and culture of things that were popular, you know, right? And I recently was staying with my father-in-law and we watched Easy Rider, right? And that's a movie from the 70s, and that epitomizes what America was like then in 1970. Just two guys riding around on motorcycles in the backcountry, you know.
I think to some end, America has never really dropped that idea of freedom as sort of being like the Wild West, where anyone can make it. And this idealized sort of social mobility where you're shit until you turn yourself into something more. If that makes sense. And this idea that governance is simply there to hold you down, especially because when you think a lot of the state's earlier histories, they were quite poorly policed. I mean, this may be controversial to say, but even in the South, although the reputation the Klan holds is very negative, and I'll be honest, in that era, everyone was pretty racist, but a lot of them actually formed as a form of local policing since they had no one, so it was a community type policing.
Right.
So I think
that happened in the Roman Empire a lot too, in its early stages.
Yeah, of course. I think basically that need for self-reliance and self-determination has basically left a lot of Americans with a cultural distrust of heavy governance that we never really had to the same extent in much of the later empire, especially New Zealand and Australia, because, I mean, New Zealand was pretty much completely government run until 1984, as I explained earlier.
Yeah, and it's very funny you should bring that up when you talk about the later stages of the empire and loving governance, because I actually recently saw a documentary, I forget who did it, but they were in rural Ghana, and there was this tribal warlord there who said they wanted the British Empire back.
Well, there actually are quite a few who feel that way. Jamaica, the Jamaican government tried heavily to turn more towards republicanism and completely leave the Commonwealth. And actually the reason they couldn't was because the people absolutely hated the idea. The people still very fondly remember the British and say, look, our living standard under the British was much stronger than it is now. Why would we move further away from them? Likewise, you've got, who was it? Actually, Malta. Malta's actually a reasonably wealthy country, but a lot of them are actually very, very fiercely pro-UK, pro-Anglo nations. There's a strong community of them in Australia. Some moved to New Zealand and Canada. And a big part of it was when Malta had the vote to go independent, the vast majority of them said no and they wanted to become a part of Britain. And Britain had actually set some seats aside in Parliament for them, expecting them to join when they saw the vote results. But the Maltese government, wanting to maintain more power as a country, declared independence, which Britain recognized immediately.
Man. And that's it really makes me wonder why the United States was successful, you know, because the only sort of other real overthrow that happened, well, the Irish came much later, but, you know, Haiti overthrew the French, and they didn't turn out quite as well as us. Obviously, they're much smaller. But it's just interesting that, because I would say most of the rest of the world, not just in the British sphere, but most of the rest of the world is not sort of government skeptic like us, as you've described, right? Or libertarian as us. I guess, do you have a theory why you think America's been so successful?
I think it's multifaceted. For one, the biggest sheer advantage the U.S. has is the obvious one of size. Two, geography played a lot into it. Europe has had multiple issues in terms of constantly being at war with each other. I mean, the European Union was formed out of World War II because of a perceived necessity to stop killing each other and to come together. And I think America didn't really have that same issue. After you had your Civil War, you had a little bit of skirmishes with, the Alamo. You had when Canada blew up your government, you had your issues with Mexico. But for the furthermost part, you've had a relatively safe and stable history to develop the country. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, a lot of other countries took a long time to begin developing concepts like human rights and freedom, whereas America established itself as a country of freedom, and that in itself was appealing to a lot of people who would hear about America from other parts of the world and be drawn there. And I think that constant influx of skills coupled with the fact that you were able to develop without having to worry about war, because America was able to, in fact, it's been historically known to push towards isolationism wherever possible, in fact, which it's doing right now. It takes it jumps out into the world for a few years and then goes back to focusing on itself, as we're seeing right now with the dawn of Trump, but anyway, I think...
My friends were surprised by that outcome, and I was not. I was not from the beginning. I predicted he would win after he gave his first speech before a Republican debate.
My belief was, I believe, to be honest with you, I don't believe Trump won. I believe the Democrats lost.
Oh, absolutely. But I knew that they wouldn't be able to handle him. Does that make any sense to you, that I knew that they would mess it up?
To be honest with you, I don't believe the Democrats deserved to win. I'm, for lack of a better word, I'm actually glad they lost. I don't like how they handled that election. Hillary Clinton went up every time she spoke. It stank of... It was as though she got up there and believed she had the right to win based on demographics. It was like, well, you're female, you have to vote for me. You're Arab, you have to vote for me. You're black, you can't vote Republican, you have to vote for me. America's so diverse now, only white men will vote for Trump, so I have to win. And then she sort of saw a lot of people actually weren't buying that. It was a very, very hollow campaign. And furthermore, a lot of Americans were turned off when they saw the DNC blatantly roll Sanders for a victory that was rightfully his.
Well, and it's funny, I really made this joke far too often, but I also believe that, to a degree, they forgot about how the Electoral College works, because they did very little in terms of campaigning in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and they acted very stunned when those states flipped, you know, and it was just like, you know, do the math, you know. But
well, to me, I saw that election as the same thing as when Obama won. Americans, the reason there were more Americans voting in those elections was because disenfranchised Americans felt as though there was a chance for change. They saw Obama. It was for the wrong reasons. It was just because predominantly he was a well-spoken black man. But even that, then they saw that as something that represented that they wanted change for America. And they voted for him twice. And to be honest with you, I don't think he was a bad president. I think if he'd run a third time, if he were able to, I think he would have won. But continuing on from that point, they also realized that there was a lot of hollowness to those claims. That so Hillary Clinton came in representing like, well, we've had a black man, it's time for a female. And I was sort of like, no, that's not the hollow kind of change we want. We want actual tangible change. And I think they saw that from both Trump and Sanders. They saw, if nothing else, these people are not establishment politicians. These are people who've really come out of nowhere, and they will show the establishment that we're not happy and we do want something different.
And being the government skeptic, libertarian type I am, you know, I always am not surprised when a lot of those things turn out hollow.
Well, no, to be honest.
That's great. So American politics, it does seem like our politics fascinate other countries. Is it really interesting for you to watch us as an outsider? I noticed the BBC came in real hard during our elections, but I saw it from all over, you know?
To be completely honest with you, I actually stopped following the election campaign. I watched the vote. I actually got sick of it, if I'm completely honest.
Well, most Americans were after about the first couple months.
Yeah, well, yeah, so that's exactly how I'd have people talking to me about what's going on in the States, and I'd say, look, I don't care, I've got my opinion now, I've watched it, I'm aware of what's going to happen. And I sat with that, I said, they've screwed that, especially at the point where I like following those sort of outsiders in the U.S. I followed Ron Paul a bit. I follow those sorts of names. I liked Gary Johnson. And so I was quite bitterly disappointed. Don't get me wrong. I didn't have a hard-on for Bernie Sanders. I liked aspects of what he said. I do believe he was – some of the things he mentioned with healthcare reform were very, very necessary to the U.S., I don't like that he kept misleading the public about Denmark and Sweden, especially calling Denmark a socialist country, which they're not. They're very, very much a laissez-faire free market economy. But I also appreciated that he was one of the few Democrats who was both – well, in fact, he's not a Democrat, but I appreciated that he was – able to criticize Israel without being unbalanced about it. He himself was a Jew. He's lived in Israel. He's able to recognize the good and the bad about it. As opposed, I find a lot of Democrats are kind of jumping on extremist views nowadays. They're really appealing to complete ignorance and anti-Semitism. I've seen Democrats align themselves with names like Farrakhan, so on. It worries me a bit, to be honest.
Well, I've always taken a very balanced approach because I'm just generally balanced on those things because I do understand that there's usually some cause of pain on all sides. I don't know why I do that, but I've always taken that approach. So, yes, it has been quite disturbing to see sort of I think both sides are getting more polarized on the issue, and it's very disturbing because it's like, how can we possibly get any real truth out of that if both of you are going to act so polarized on the issue? And yes, it's very disturbing. Yeah, I've seen lots of. It's really weird to see people who call themselves Democrats and claim to be tolerant people then to say very anti-Semitic things. I don't know if you've heard of Ben Shapiro.
Yes,
but he is the number one target of anti-Semitic threats. He's been called. He's literally been. I think was it the ACLU or the Southern Poverty Law Center said he's the number one target of anti-Semitic threats, which is just it's mind blowing, right? You know, it's like wow, you know, this is it's crazy to hear some of the rhetoric I've heard.
Well, a lot of people, unfortunately, I don't want to take us on too much of a tangent there.
Oh, no, absolutely.
I will say, I think too many people begin to confuse legitimate criticism of Israeli policies with disproportionately just going on them, especially from a sort of left-leaning community who have heavily adopted Muslims as a sort of target base because for one, there's so many of them, and two, they see them as oppressed people getting a lot of racism from the West, so on and so forth. And coming as a citizen of a Muslim nation, I must say a lot of people don't realize how heavy anti-Semitism is wrapped in the cultures of those countries. Right. And Morocco is one of the stricter nations in terms of having strict laws punishing anti-Semitic acts. But you still see a lot of it there. When the king started enforcing stricter penalties on anti-Semitism in Morocco, you started seeing people say, oh, it's because his mother's a Jew, or oh, he's a secret Jew and shit like that. Just really disgusting anti-Semitic. He's not a Jew. As far as I'm aware, he's not a Jew. But it's that belief that the Jews have intercepted the government. That's the only reason there's someone defending them. That sort of belief. And I don't actually think the left-leaning crowds like the Democrats themselves are knowingly anti-Semitic to some extent. I think, to be completely honest, I believe the American left are becoming more and more naive and, I suppose, gullible. Did you hear about there was actually an Al-Qaeda recruiting document found by the U.S. intelligence, and it said to recruit lefties because they're naive.
That's hilarious. I didn't hear about that, but I'm not surprised in any shape or form. I will say, though, I think a lot of this boils down to, I don't know how to describe it, I think American propaganda. I think our news media is atrocious for being propaganda. I that's something I didn't put on our list, but I think I'd like to talk about that more a little bit. Do you see American news as propaganda?
Well, I guess the first question you should be asking is, do I see American news? To which I say I... I've watched... No. Let's be real. I've seen your news networks. I've watched a bit of CNN. I've watched Fox. I've even gone off the mainstream rail and checked out things like, Ben Shapiro for one, but I've looked at things like Rebel Media. No, that's Canadian. Sorry.
That's Canadian Rebel. Have you been to InfoWars?
InfoWars, AJ Plus.
Yeah, New York InfoWars.
That's a very interesting one. Alex Jones is, if nothing else, he's entertaining.
Oh man, there's so many people that are so mad about him, and it's just very funny. I joke I was Alex Jones before it was cool, because my grandmother was into alternative medicine in the 80s, and she's mm-hmm. always been pushing conspiracy theories. So,
as far as American media goes, I think the biggest issue I consistently see is partisanship. What you've got here is media generally either leans left or right, but they don't side too heavily with a party as much as they side with their left or right spectrum. So if a party does something they disagree with, they'll criticize that party for it. Whereas in America, I see your media very much identifies with a specific party. It's either Republican media or it's Democrat media. What was her name? Rachel Maddow?
Yeah. A lot of people criticize her for being like a DNC hack. Even people who I know who are socialists or liberals criticize her.
She's very much, I mean, recently she had a bit of a meltdown over Trump talking to Trump agreeing to try and negotiate with North Korea. Whereas, as I remember, not too long ago, she was a fierce proponent of Obama's agreement with Iran.
Yes, you find those things constantly. I guess I asked this because I wonder if that's a consequence of us having such a strong free speech tradition. you know, so we don't have any standards. We're just like, we're going to go out there and we're going to say, everybody gets a microphone.
Well, see, it's funny because New Zealand has a lot. We don't just have freedom of speech. We've got several freedoms, from freedom of religion, freedom of expression. We've got about seven different freedoms in that regard. So they cover everything from what you wear to what you believe, so on and so forth. And however, when it comes to presenting something in the media, we do have quite a few regulations in that if something is presented as fact, it has to be presented as fact. If something's an opinion piece, it has to clearly state that it's an opinion piece.
Yeah, and I don't really think we have it quite that way. And I think that's why people, I don't know what everyone outside of America perceives, but I've always perceived, you know, people like the BBC, but also other places like RTE and Deutsche Welle to a degree and other things as more reliable than our news. Especially when talking about America.
I tend not to follow American media at this point. I don't trust it. I find it very, very alarmist. I've watched stories in which there are events, same event, and the BBC would be saying there's no cause for alarm, nothing's wrong. And then I see, in fact, I watched a video where someone compiled the difference in headlines between American and other countries. And yeah, for the same event, the BBC said, we and the government would like to affirm that there is no cause for alarm, just continue about your day normally. And then it switched to the American media. It was like, oh my, and the guy had his hands in his hair and he was yelling, we're all going to die, there's something wrong, be prepared, everyone. And why?
Well, you should watch this movie from the 70s. It's called Network. And you'll understand the American media in a nutshell after you watch that movie. I think it was a total indictment, and I wonder if it prophesied a lot of things that came true.
That sounds interesting. I'm happy to watch that. Could I ask about? It's tangent, but it's related as well.
Oh sure.
Your view. We've come from America's past ties with other countries.
Right.
Let's talk about present into future for the U.S. Do you agree with where America has itself intertwined? Do you prefer Obama's style of sort of heavy diplomacy and a very clear focus on Western-centric, that's including the EU, sort of Western-focused interest? Do you prefer Trump's sort of non-interventionalist, we'll negotiate where we have to, we'll come back with heavy military defense if we have to, otherwise we would prefer to keep America to ourselves? How do you feel about Trump being so heavily pro-Israel? As you can expect, I obviously am happy with that, but I have a bias in that.
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. Well, if you really want to boil down to my philosophy on a lot of those things, I am probably beyond the sort of average right-left American spectrum in a way. Mm. So I'm very skeptical of it all. I really think that we have overextended ourselves, but it's not just a Obama or Trump has overextended ourselves thing. I think we've been overextending ourselves for the past 40 years. You know, I think we get involved in way too many situations where there's no good outcome for us, especially since Vietnam.
40 years would be around the time America took a stance of having a lot of military bases internationally. It would be around the same time America pushed the United Kingdom to look at joining the European Union, if I remember correctly.
Right.
The U.S. did that. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. I'll let you finish.
The U.S. cited that it was concerned that a Franco-German Union could lead towards heavy de Gaullism and even potentially a Fourth Reich, and it wanted more Anglo influence through the U.K.
That's hilarious. I don't think I've ever heard that, but again, I'm not surprised. Have you ever heard of Henry Kissinger?
Yes, I have.
Yes, I'm an extreme opponent of his ideology. I think he, I think his influence sort of really changed us away from our isolationist roots. And I'm not even, I don't want to make it sound like I'm an isolationist. I don't believe we shouldn't have free trade with people. Okay. I don't believe in trade deals in the aspect is I don't think the government should really set a ton of boundaries on trade. My issue is our military interventionism. I just don't think it's worked out very well for us, generally speaking. You know? But I understand why people want us to help them. I understand why we feel like we need to sometimes, but it just... I have friends who are veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, and I don't know. I feel like they were grossly misled in what was going to happen to them.
Well, coming from that, I think a lot of people, when they, especially in the modern era, when they think of American interventionism, they think of they think of Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, where the U.S. clearly went in on quagmires and on false pretenses. It was obvious the U.S. was hoping for a repeat of South Korea, where they'd be able to go in and influence positive change both for the nation and American interests in the region. However, unfortunately, we ended up something more like Vietnam.
Yes. I don't know, and that's a tricky thing, right? Because you can't necessarily argue that that's a total wrong direction, right? Because if we want to talk about the Anglosphere, you know, the UK did it for years, right? But
exactly.
But at the same token, it just doesn't seem like our success rate's very high, in my opinion. So I don't know what the answer is. If it were up to me, I guess I would, like I said, I think we may have said this once in the comment section somewhere when we met on Facebook, but I wish we could be like the Swiss, but we're just too large, so I get sad.
I think the big thing is you have to go into a country that knowingly and actively wants you to come. The biggest issue is Iraq, Libya's a bit different. A lot of Libyans did want Muammar Gaddafi out. So what happened there was more so just a result of several factors that all came in at once due to poorly thought out Clinton-led international policy. With the case of Iraq, it was a very different thing. A lot of Iraqis were actually quite staunchly fond of Saddam's governance, and a lot of them, to this day, a lot of them supported the Iraqi invasion in Kuwait. And so when they saw America go and place sanctions on them for that, a lot of them became quite upset by that, because for them, the story was, the only reason Kuwait is no longer a part of Iraq was because of the borders drawn by the colonial forces. So they saw that as, well, we're just reclaiming our southern region. And now we're being punished for that by more colonial oppressors.
Right, and that's sort of what the story I had heard there, you know, and I don't know what to say. I mean, I guess it's sort of like America's current... head of the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan. He has some strong views on things, but if you'll notice, it was almost like he was dragged into that job, right? They basically asked him, begged and pleaded with him. Even some Democrats did, right? And he really reluctantly took that role. And that's how I feel we kind of are on the international stage now. Except for when Hillary Clinton leads invasions of Libya, then I don't know who's in charge.
I think the big thing is people underestimate ground guerrilla might. And the biggest thing is a lot of these countries, like Vietnam, Americans thought that they were going into a war where people were oppressed by their government and they were going to be welcoming Americans and helping them. They got there and they found people who largely hated their presence, mostly wanted them dead. And the rest pretended to like them for money. So when you're literally, you've got a disadvantage in terms of terrain, you're in completely foreign ground, you're not just fighting troops, you're literally fighting civilians, and you have an obligation to attempt to establish who is a civilian versus who is a guerrilla troop, it makes it much easier to divide and conquer, and that's what America's found, and that's what I think is going to keep happening until the U.S. really gets a clear foundation and understanding of who it's supporting and why. Because now you've got, well, I mean, for one, we don't even know who really backs these wars. It seems most people are just blaming neocons at this point, and everyone's asking, well, who are these neocons? Because it seems both within the Democrats and the Republicans, we've got people claiming both to support and hate the wars.
Right, and that's sort of the Orwellian nightmare that most of us really staunch libertarian-leaning people in America fear.
Yeah, and it's a pretty well-founded thing to fear because, unfortunately, it's become reality there.
Yeah, so if you're asking me where I think the future goes, I hope that revolution in our government changes. Well, not revolution, that sounds a little extreme. There's my John Lennon reference. But I hope that we would be able to sort of... I see Trump as kind of a mild reformer. I don't know. I don't personally like his rhetoric very much, if you will.
Agreed.
But he has done a couple of useful things for some people, you know.
I see Obama and Trump as both being catalysts. They've both shown that there is a desire for change and that Americans will go out of their way to try and find a way to bring about that change. And the fact they've gone for Trump sort of, we would hope it shows the Democrats that, look, Americans, even if they don't agree with the guy, because a lot of people don't like Trump, they will still vote if it means showing the establishment that they want that change. Unfortunately, the DNC, because they're complete idiots, have learned nothing and look as though they're going to blow another campaign in 2020 and the midterms this year. But that aside...
that aside. We'll see. Maybe they'll change. I don't know. But, yeah, so if you're asking me what I think of the future, I would hope that people would realize before it's too late that this massive military interventionism plan isn't working very well for us, but I worry that we're gonna go the way of Rome and just keep funding that until we're bankrupt. And we kind of are bankrupt. I mean, we're trillions of dollars in debt. I don't even know how far it goes. But I don't know. But then again, you look at the UK, and it's never totally died either, like Rome did. So it's hard to say. It's really hard to say. And I also can't really say that I see another country out there that's more powerful than us, you know? Like, I look at China, well, no. And they look like they're about to turn into a wreck again. I look at Russia, they're obviously a wreck. Maybe India, but they seem like a wreck, too. So,
I'm of the opinion that if and when the United States falls, it will be by its own hand. It will collapse upon itself. It's quite honestly too big to fail, as far as I'm concerned. Well, too big to be taken down. It can take itself down, and I think the division because there is a clear divide and a perception of lack of representation between the federal government and citizens. I think a lot of people are getting better representation from their state governments, whereas they feel as though the federal government is just this big complex that doesn't represent them and doesn't actually hear them.
Absolutely, but as my favorite writer, Thomas Jefferson, argued, that's traditional. That's how it's always been.
Unfortunate. I suppose to answer that same question I asked you about New Zealand for the
right,
future.
Right, that's how we'll sort of close. We'll let you talk about the future of New Zealand some. I don't know where it goes. The sky's the limit for New Zealand right now, isn't it?
Well, I suppose to talk about the future, we have to look at our past. And As I mentioned, Australia actually wrote in a clause to allow us to become a state if we so chose. The Australians actually thought that we wouldn't make it past the 70s before joining the Commonwealth of Australia. And their former Prime Minister John Howard actually famously asked our Prime Minister Helen Clark if we'd reconsider joining Australia, with which she said, keep dreaming.
Oh my, should you worry about an Australian invasion?
No, I think quite the opposite. They've had more of I suppose it's funny you should say that because it's relevant to what I was saying. There's historically, New Zealand and Australia have a borderless migration deal. So any citizen of Australia can move to New Zealand at any given time. Any citizen of New Zealand can set up residence in Australia at any given time. We simply have to fly over and indicate at customs that we would like to permanently reside in the other country. For the longest time, this has been rather one-sided in Australia's favor, in that lots of New Zealanders have been moving over there. However, since roughly, it's actually been a few years now, maybe 2014, 2015, that flow has actually been more in New Zealand's favor, in that we've been gaining more migrants from Australia. That includes returning New Zealanders, but we've been gaining more than we've been losing. So I suppose there is a possibility of invasion in the one sense.
There's always an invasion of some kind.
Yeah, in a way. What I'd like to see coming forward, you mentioned New Zealand being kind of at the mercy of superpowers, and we're in an interesting position where our key trading partners, Australia and China on their own, make up over 50% of New Zealand's economy. Those two countries on their own.
Man, I'd be Australia's
largest trading partner. I'm not too worried about Australia as far as I'm concerned. Although it's disproportionate, Australia still has a lot of its economy, especially in finance, tied up in New Zealand. All of our banks are owned by Australia. If they fall, that's a fair percentage of the Aussie GDP. It's in their best interest, and both as friends, to work together. As far as I'm more concerned about China.
I don't blame you. China, they look like they're about heading for some kind of weird things. I don't know. It's quite odd. They look like they're overdue for some kind of upheaval.
Well, I think the biggest concern for me, to be honest with you, is the fact that China has historically used Chinese immigration to instill loyalty to the Chinese nation, Chinese Republic abroad. They did it with Singapore. They attempted to do it much of Southeast Asia. And I'll admit, just due to recent issues in which Australia and New Zealand have discovered spies and so on and so forth, I'm very, very skeptical in that regard. But beyond that, I'm also relatively... That's not to say I have an issue with Chinese immigration, because I don't. And I don't want any commenters, especially those who may have an issue with Chinese, to use me as an example of someone backing their rhetoric, because no, I do believe it. Chinese New Zealanders are as Kiwi as anyone else. So please, no one take it in that direction. I'm just saying I do believe that there is, I don't trust the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, and I do have reason to suspect through evidence we've found that they may be sneaking some of their own influence in through people who are coming to New Zealand. I fully back anyone who legitimately wants to move here and make it home, as we do have a lot of Chinese, and a lot of them are very, very patriotic New Zealanders who left due to the issues themselves not trusting the Chinese government, which I fully understand and respect. But beyond that, I think one issue we're having as well is a lot of wealthy Chinese don't trust their own economy as well, And so they're trying to move a lot of money abroad, especially focusing on Canada, Australia, and New Zealand at the moment, which has become a big issue. A lot of speculation, millions of dollars coming in, you know?
Yes. That's we've had that issue here before, too. Not to that degree.
As far as my ideal future, I've been heavily backing the Kanzik project, which is basically an idea of a free trade movement zone, potentially a closed block, a trade block somewhat like the EU between Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK after Britain leaves the EU. New Zealand's currently negotiating trade deals with the EU as well. The US is a major trading partner for us, but unfortunately, I think we are just a little bit too insignificant for the US to focus on. Our best odds at securing a good deal with the US would have been during the Iraq War, where George Bush offered us a free trade deal had we supported your invasion. Our Prime Minister at the time, Helen Clark, objected to doing so, believing that the invasion was on false premises, which she was right about.
100% so, correct.
But yeah, I don't think, especially with Trump, who very much seems to view trade as a zero-sum game.
Yes, that is probably my biggest gripe with his current administration.
I don't support protectionism. I don't believe it works. I've got zero evidence historically to believe protectionism works. I oppose Trump on that ground quite heavily. I think New Zealand's best interests are trying to focus on maybe establishing Kanzik as a thing, so close ties of Canada and the UK, seeing if together as a block, the four of us could negotiate a good trade deal with the United States, and maintaining good friendships with India, with Latin America, who we're actually an observing member of Mercosur, which is a Latin American trade union.
Really? I didn't realize New Zealand was part of that.
We're an observer state, not a full member.
Ah.
Likewise, us in Australia have a close trade relationship with ASEAN. In fact, I think, yeah, there's something, we've got something going on with ASEAN between Australia and New Zealand, and New Zealand's also negotiated two very important free trade deals with India and China. I want us to maintain those, try and get our free trade going with the UK immediately after Brexit, form a tight one with the EU, and get something going with the GCC.
So what I'm kind of hearing is the future of New Zealand is kind of a reemergence of the Anglosphere in a way. In an economic sense, you know. Not to probably the degree it was before under colonialism, obviously, but, you know, sort of...
I'm never going to say we need to move away from Asia. What I'm saying, I'm very pro-Asia. I want to see us get closer with ASEAN. I want to see our close relationship with India build. Where I'm mostly skeptical is our heavy reliance on China. I want to see us diversify. I want to see more from... If we can get something from the US, that'd be great, but I'm not particularly focused on you guys as you are right now because I don't think Trump is an avenue worth looking at. I think we need to really build on our relationship with Mercosur, get a lot more trade and migration routes going with Latin America. I think we need to see a lot. India, Latin America... For me, the Anglosphere wasn't something I was particularly looking at until Brexit. With Britain out of the EU soon, I think the Anglosphere really could be a very, very, very lucrative and viable angle for New Zealand, but not one that's worth sacrificing our Asian trade market with, if that makes sense.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. It is interesting, though. Like I think we had said in another section of the comments, you know, I can see the appeal to some people in the UK of re-emergence of the Anglosphere and sort of a a little bit of mistrust of the European Union, and especially of the Franco-German influence in it.
Oh, I fully understand why they left, and whilst I can see benefits to remaining as well as leaving, I personally back the leave camp. I support the vote to leave the EU for Britain. I believe that whilst the EU is amazing in certain areas, I think Britain and Europe have two very different views of where they want to go forward, and I think they're better working as friends separately than working together.
Well, I guess, is there anything else you want to say about New Zealand in close? I think we've really covered quite a lot of ground here. This is one heck of a podcast. It's really been awesome hearing other perspectives, you know.
Nothing really. I'd like to welcome anyone who wants to come visit. Our tourism industry is always welcome to Americans, Canadians, and wherever else your viewers your listeners may be located. I'd like to personally thank you for the invite to join your podcast. It's been great.
Yeah, it's cool. And this one will be airing. I've recorded two for this week, so now I get I'm a little ahead of schedule. So I'm really excited about that. And yeah, likewise, it's so great to hear in New Zealand. Let's see. I was going to say there was one other thing I knew about New Zealand. On public television here in America, they have one about a chef from New Zealand. They have a show about her.
Huh.
Yeah. Her name's Annabelle Lee. That covers what I know about New Zealand. It's been very great, man. And I'll go ahead and sign off here before we bore everybody to tears. But it's been a great podcast. And we'll have to – maybe we'll catch up again sometime. We'll definitely –
feel free.
Yeah. So thanks for listening, everyone. Check out the Know Your Place podcast on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/knowyourplacepodcast, all one word, or on Facebook at facebook.com/knowyourplacepodcast, all one word. And we will be coming soon to YouTube and iTunes, and maybe another social media platform near you. Special thanks to my wife, Sarah, and Jay Graff for the riff.